Thanks for joining us for the executive series. Today I'm speaking with Todd Warren, who is the head of research at Tribeca Investment Partners. Todd, really good to talk to you.
Thanks, Adam.
It's a really timely conversation given what we're seeing going on in commodity markets at the moment. One of the things that stands out is that there are several secular themes that have taken root in recent years, but they seem to have gone another level in recent times. The decarbonisation of the economy, that is playing out very significantly in commodity markets.
Yeah.
Oh, look, absolutely. What excites us is that this is really a global phenomenon, and it's a whole new level of demand that we've never seen. This is not just, you know, the uptick in the cycle as we do see in resources. This is a level of demand for many commodities which we've never experienced.
Yep.
And what's really exciting is it's not short term. This is multi-year, multi-decade, indeed, in nature.
So, obviously, it's all about catalysts. China has been a significant part of this discussion for some time, but I suppose it's the secondary and tertiary catalysts. And we've recently had the administration in the US come behind this thematic in a pretty big way.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, it started, you know, decarbonisation was obviously a strong theme for the Europeans and has been, to your point, for quite some time, for a number of years. With obviously the net zero target starting to be announced, the Biden administration talked about 2050, Chinese have talked about 2060, but I think we're up over 130 countries now that have set their net zero targets. So as I say, it's global in nature. God forbid we might actually see the Australians come to the party at some point. But yeah, the point being that to hit these targets though, I don't think the world really comprehends just how much investment has to be made and what indeed that means. You can't decarbonise without many of the commodities that you know we can talk to.
Indeed. So something that we hear a lot about, for example, is the electrification of the global car and truck fleet. Yeah. I suppose to your point, like trying to get some sort of conceptual understanding of what that requires in terms of electricity, you need copper fundamentally. Yeah. How is the world positioned to be able to meet these demand challenges?
So much to unwrap in that. Yep. I mean, you know, firstly, yes, the electrification of the vehicle fleet is a huge one. And the first number to think about here is that an electric vehicle, on average, needs four times as much copper as an internal combustion engine vehicle. So even if we don't add to that vehicle fleet, you've got four times as much copper that needs to be consumed or will be demanded. But what does that all mean? You know, how do you make that into a number that people can really understand? Tesla. Obviously a high profile electric vehicle manufacturer. They had their battery day last September and they've set some pretty heroic targets, frankly, with regard to their vehicle rollout. So they're targeting 20 million vehicles, electric vehicles by 2030. To put that in numbers, they will consume more than 100% of the world's lithium consumption in 2020. That's Tesla alone.
Yep.
Now you put in Volkswagen, you put in insert name of Chinese auto manufacturer here, they're all the same. And they've all got really aggressive targets. Yep. And indeed, that's accelerating. Excuse the pun.
Yep.
So that, you know, lithium, copper. Copper's a huge one. You know, so Tesla alone, you know, roughly 10% they would consume of the world's copper market. But importantly, we've been in a downturn for investment in the cycle. Now, why is that? Because capital markets have all said to all the mining companies, whatever you do, don't put your money in the ground. We want you to pay down debt. We want you to buy back your stock. We want you to pay a dividend. Just don't put it in the ground. Yep. So we now find ourselves in a situation today where copper's starting to respond, lithium's starting to respond, and we've got, as I say, this multi-decade phenomenon with regards to demand, and yet we can't do anything about it, not easily.
Yep.
So you say, well, yes, copper's at $4.50. Well, Freeport McMoRan, Western world's biggest copper producer, came out with their Q1 results, and they've openly said, and bearing in mind this is a company that's got arguably one of the best development portfolios, we can't meaningfully respond even if copper goes to $10 a pound within a 7 or 8 year time frame. So that's kind of stark when you say, well, but normally high prices are solved by more supply. It's not that easy this time around because of underinvestment against that backdrop of massively increased demand.
So that presents quite an interesting challenge when you're trying to isolate investment targets because some organisations are going to be very effective in deploying capital and being able to meet that supply response.
Yep.
How do you navigate this situation?
Yeah, good question. It's challenging because, frankly, there's actually not that many producers of copper, as we know, on the Australian marketplace.
Yeah.
You can count them on one hand,
yeah,
how many actually produce a pound of copper today.
Yeah.
For us, and that's why we're a global investor, frankly, you know, the opportunity set is broader.
Yeah.
And indeed, you know, all of our copper producing exposure today is offshore.
Yep.
But with that comes its own challenges. And also, I guess that plays into that supply challenge. Geopolitics is only getting more and more challenging for the supply side. So your ability to permit a new mine has never been more challenging.
Yep.
The Biden administration have talked all up their net zero targets. And yet last week, they also talked about, well, we don't want to mine it, we just want to process it.
Yep.
Well, it's not that easy.
Yep.
So therein lies another challenge in terms of that supply response. Chile and Peru, they supply 40% of the world's copper. And yet right now you've got a discussion going on in Chile with a new constitutional referendum going on, where they're looking to completely shift their fiscal regime, which could meaningfully increase the tax take for the state.
Yep.
Now, if you're sitting on an undeveloped resource, are you going to put a lot of money into the ground when you're not sure what the economics are going to be?
Yeah.
No, not quickly. Peru, just going through a presidential election, that leading candidate, we don't know the outcome just yet, he's a hard left candidate who's talked about nationalisation of the mining sector. Again, you're not going to put a lot of money in the ground when you don't think it's going to be back in your pocket. So all of these challenges are really difficult to get exposure to. But again, as I say, invest globally, and the opportunity set is more broad.
So I suppose it kind of dials in with the decarbonising discussion. Uranium has been something that we have seen unloved from an investment perspective for probably a decade or maybe even more. Where do you see that lying in this story, given the fact that it can probably deliver the fastest results when it comes to decarbonising?
Really good point. So uranium, as you rightly point out, been a difficult conversation for, as you say, at least 10 years, certainly since Fukushima. What's really interesting, though, is that conversation is starting to shift, we think. Still, there's a degree of NIMBYism that comes with the territory, and will do for some time. But when you've got the Biden administration, for example, they have added uranium to their critical minerals list. So on that list, you'll see copper and nickel and rare earths and lithium, and what you would expect to see on there, but they've added uranium.
Yep.
Now, why is that? Well, they produce around about 20% of their power, maybe a little bit more, from nuclear right now. And they had originally planned to roll that down to zero by decommissioning their nukes. They're stepping back from that as we speak, because they know to hit that 2050 net zero target, they can't just invest a whole lot in solar panels and wind farms. You need that baseload power support that will come from nuclear, which is low or zero carbon, and can support that environment of renewables. The Europeans, they actually pulled right back from nuclear energy on the back of Fukushima. The Germans turned off their nuclear facilities and turned on their coal-fired facilities. Kind of unusual decision given the backdrop in Europe, as we talked about. Yes. But what you're seeing now is this propensity or possibility, at least, that they will add nuclear energy to their sustainable finance taxonomy. Not decided yet, and nothing happens quickly within the EU. But that's, again, that possible shift in conversation. You would have heard the other day in Australia that Grant King has talked about, well, maybe we should be thinking about nuclear. Now, we haven't done in Australia for a very long time because of our coal fire.
Yep.
But maybe that's an alternative to the solution. So it's a really, I mean, we do invest quite heavily in uranium producers and developers. And it's been, arguably, we've been too soon, frankly, you know, if I hark my mind back 12 months, but we're really starting to see that interest return. And we think, you know, it's one of our biggest exposures within the fund, because we think there's when this moves, it's going to be quite spectacular.
So when you talk about all of those factors and you put the lens over the stock universe, quite a lot of risks to manage, what are the key things that you've had front of mind when you made your investment decisions?
So, well, a couple of things. When you're looking at resources, you know, people, there's a lot of discussion about ESG.
Yep.
And that's become a real buzz phrase for many investors. frankly speaking, whilst it hasn't been a buzz phrase for resources, we've had to, throughout our careers, assess ESG factors, because you can't invest in a project if you're concerned about the environmental impact, because at some point it will come back to hurt you.
Yep.
You can't invest in something that doesn't have a social license to operate. Because
yep.
frankly speaking, it doesn't matter how good your geology is, if you've got no social license to operate,
yep.
bearing in mind that these projects are often in
sensitive areas,
you know, they're demographically challenged areas, yep. or, you know, developing countries.
Yep.
So they face all those challenges socially. So if you don't have a social license to operate, you don't have a project.
Yeah.
And then the other factor here, of course, is geopolitics,
yep.
and those governance factors. And so you need to be considering all of these factors all of the time, not just because it's a buzz phrase.
Yep.
So that's crucial. Of course, any investment in resources, you're looking at the geology,
yep.
you know, what's the quality of the rocks. And certainly within, you know, our team, we've got a team of people, one of the largest, certainly in Australia, that has a couple of decades of experience, and both financial and technical.
Yep.
So it's not just looking at a balance sheet and working out whether it stacks up, but also looking at the rocks in the ground. And the nice thing about this sector is that it's tangible. You can actually get out there and touch and feel what you're investing in. So you know, you need to be able to do that.
Which is a refreshing change compared to some other investment themes that go on at the moment. But Todd, a great conversation. Thanks very much for your time, and look forward to having more chats in coming months.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And thanks very much for joining us for the Executive Series.